Sean O'Callaghan, you're very welcome to Radio Kerry. Would Kerry mean a lot to you, and you have a lot of friends in Kerry, of course?
Not alone that, but one of my great memories of Kerry, when I was 10 and 12, there was a people here in Dublin, Cushton the Boston, and they sent 20 or 30 young boys and girls to Kerry and Galway, Gaeltacht. To improve their Irish. Now, my Irish was quite good because I started as in an all-Irish speaking school, and then I went on to Colossus Willa in Parnell Square for my secondary education. So my Irish was quite good from that, but I was sent any at 10 years of age down to Ballyferritra, to a place called Farn, and to a lovely people called Boulair, Liam Boulair, and the son was Mirish Boulair. 50 years after going down and having my holidays in Kerry as a kid, I went back there with my wife to show her where I went when I was only a young kid. And there it was the same house. The Sacred Heart picture was still on the wall with a little red lamp under it. And the old clock was still, the grandfather clock was still there, the very same as it was 50 years previously. And I met the man of the house, who was Murish. He was older than I was when I went down there. And there was Murish, a master scholar. And that's where I learned a good lot of the Irish that I didn't learn in Dublin. But then, funnily enough, when I started in the national school, I had three Kerry teachers, Murish O'Gohan, Tomás Levade, and Seamus O'Shea. And they were all from around Cahersiveen and places like that. So it's a marvellous thing to say that I can still remember all the things I did.
It's absolutely amazing to think that your Sunday night results GAA programme is the longest running GAA programme in the whole world. It's simply stunning. Talk to us about your programme and your dad.
And that's confirmed by Guinness Book of Records. They sent me a letter to go for a record of the longest broadcaster in the world. And I did that, and so far they're assessing all, they had to put that into the Guinness Book of Record, and they had to reply to all the people who were making claims all over the world for that particular programme. But I held, as I thought, the longest running record as a presenter of the programme as well, until I found out there was a man called Pierre Agrelot from Puerto Rico. He was the longest running broadcaster in the world, according to Guinness Book of Records. And then I went for the longest running programme in the world. And that was held, they told me, by a family called Gambling, Rambling with Gambling in New York. And they had been doing the programme 2 years before I made my claim. And the lad Agrelot, he was 2 years as well, for the single one of the longest-serving presenter. Both of them are all dead, so now I can claim both on the longest presenter of a programme and the longest programme itself that's running in the world.
And what's the history of that wonderful programme? And go back and talk to me about how it all started and how it all began and how you took over.
Well, let's say, my father, first of all, started that programme around 1931. Now, when I say 1931, he went into Mairead Ní Graida, and who was the chief supervisor and the newsreader in 2RN on radio. We heard that, as you know, in a very good lecture by Owen Corry, and he mentioned about 2RN. And he suggested to Mairead Ní Graida to give them the main results of the day, of the GAA results. So she took a while to think it over, but then she said, "Look, give me the most important one." So before he went on air himself, he was giving these results into Radio Wayne or 2RN at the time. So eventually Mairead says, "Listen, Sean, why don't you try and do this programme yourself?" He went to them and told them that the GAA was beginning now to mount much interest around the country with the results, and why not start a programme myself and put it on? So the director says, "Do it for 5 minutes and we'll see how it goes." So he did it for 5 minutes for the first time. He did it in January the 4th, 1932. And then it went on, the people were ringing in more results, and eventually they decided that they would put him on for 10 minutes. That extended to 15 minutes. And 15 minutes it remained for 1932 up to 1953 was the length of time it took my father to do that program. Now, he developed an irritating cough, and it meant that in those days you didn't record anything, it was all live. So anything like that could be a bit of a nuisance. So Frank McManus, the talk's feature man, rang me up and said, listen, your father's cough is getting a little bit irritating. And he stops, tries to clear his throat, and he goes on again, and this can't go on. So he says, what I'm saying to you is that as and from next Sunday, this was on a Monday when he said this to me, next Sunday I want you to take over the program yourself from your father. Now, what annoyed me, and I felt it very, very hard, was to go home to tell my own father that he no longer was doing this program, which had become very, very popular, and I was to do it. Now, I thought maybe the Radio Éireann themselves should have done that, not me. But my father was shocked when I told him, and I said to him, look, it's either I do it or they'll get somebody else to do it. And I said, it came as a shock to me to be asked to do this, and that they would at least write to you and tell you they were making the change. And that's the way it ended up.
Did it always hold the same time, Sean, going out at the same time?
No, during that period, Rishi, it started at 10 o'clock at night, and then it went to 10:30, and finally it ended up at 11 o'clock, which suited him better because he used to go to matches like the Ulster football final. Now, I was helping him out because I would look after all the results that were coming in the Radio Éireann, and I would be in there myself. So I was getting a good briefing all along the line. But eventually it came to the stage when that had to change, and they left it at 11 o'clock, and it has remained at 11 o'clock ever since.
Now, Sean, for the sake of our listeners who have never heard the programme, explain to us exactly what happens and what the programme is all about, and how do all these results come into you?
Well, let's say when my father started the programme, I should have said to you that he had soccer results, he had handball results, and he had athletics as well. Like, his was a general programme, and it was the first magazine-type programme on air at that time. But eventually what happened is the pressure came along to have more time for the GAA results that were coming in. Yeah. So it meant dropping all the little things that he had on the programme. Yeah. Like if he had the athletics, they all went. And eventually all the soccer results had to be dropped from the programme, much to the annoyance of the soccer people. And developed a row between my father, the radio, and the soccer people. So eventually my father said to J.L. Brennan, who at the time was secretary of the FAI, that why not get their own programme and do as he had done? And eventually that's the way they got out of it. The broadcasting people gave the soccer people a programme all of their own. Now, my father at the time, when he was collecting results, there were very few telephones in the country, as we heard from Owen Cardy's lecture there, except the local sergeant in the Garda station would have a telephone, the parish priest would have a telephone, and the principal in the local schools would have a telephone. And that's the way the system he built up was, getting in touch with these people, to have somebody there to give them the big results of the day in those particular counties.
How do you get the results in today now? I presume through emails and all this crack. Yeah.
Now we have the internet. Yeah. Now we have the fax. Yeah. Now we have the text coming in. Now we have the PROs and the GAA. We also have freelance fellows doing results. Yeah. So that's no problem now, filling a programme.
Sean, when do the results start coming into you? Are you sitting down at home? I'm trying to get a picture now of Sean Og of a Sunday. Are you sitting down in the afternoon? No, are you going to a studio? What happens?
When I took over, you see, I was doing the same as he was doing. My mother used to get calls. We had a phone, and they would come in to her. She would take them. And when I'd come back from a match, then I'd go straight into Radio Éireann. And I would sit there, and the calls then came in the normal way on the telephone from people in various parts of the country. And like as my father had done, I would get the results in that way.
Sean, I never cease to be amazed listening to your results and reading results in papers and things. The wonderful names in the clubs all over Ireland. You'd hear names in your programme that no one had ever known a club existed.
As a matter of fact, I'll tell you one little story in a minute now about that. It's an amazing to say that at times I have to make sure that I have the right pronunciation. Yes. Of little. For instance, there's a club in Cavan, and Crosser Lough. That's the way you say it. But it's not. It's Crusher Lough. That's the way they go. And that would apply to a lot of the club names that I use. I have to get it right because they'd say, ring me up and say, you didn't pronounce that right. So they put you in your place. And please God, I'll keep doing that and hopefully it's the right one. But I got a lovely letter from a journalist and his name was Austin O'Callaghan. And he was working for the BBC Sport. And this is only now a week ago. And he wrote me a lovely letter with an enclosure. And he says, my aunt, naming her, who worked in Dublin and was a student in UCD, and she got very lonely and had been so far away from home. She was from Roscommon. And she missed her parents. She missed living with them. And then one night she happened to be listening to Sean Ogre's results. And didn't she hear Strokestown had beaten St. Bridget's in a very important championship match. And the fact of mentioning Strokestown, her own little village where she worked, that she was really delighted. And she wrote me and she put into a beautiful poem called Sean Oak, Come Home With Me. And she says that gave her the courage when she was finished to go back home again. But she wrote this, and I have it. And I'm trying now to see if somebody may be able to print it in some newspaper or someplace. I'll even give you a copy of it, Weeshie, and you could read it because it's the most beautiful thing that was ever written. And it said, come home with me, Sean Og.
Well, Sean Og, I tell you this, I write a column in the local Kerryman every week, and if I get your copy, I'll print that in the Kerryman. It would be wonderful. Now, my own club, Killarney Legion, I often heard you calling it out, and every little club loves to hear their name called out. By the way, for the sake of all listeners, what's the name of the programme? What time does it go out every Sunday night? Because people are going to be listening in more now after listening to this.
Well, now I can tell you, it's called GAA Results with Sean Ogre Callaghan. At this time of the year, when there are no club matches at all, I do interviews. And that has now provoked a lot of great interest too. Because now I'm going to all the units of the GAA in Australasia, in the North American Board, in London, in Hertfordshire, and all these places where the GAA have associations. I will call them the units of the association. And I'll keep doing that until the club matches now come back again. I had Terry Connaughton from Roscommon, former president of the New York GAA, and he does a very good piece. I've Eamon Kelly on the North American Board, a Dublin man who lived very near me and for years has been living in Chicago, and now he's does all the work for them there, the PRO and the secretary of the North American Board. I'm going to have in a week or two a lad called Gerald Rowe, who was born in Belfast and is now out in Australia. And their area covers 5,000 miles. That's his area. And you'll be hearing about how they play their matches, how they referee them, and how they get people to do the matches as well.
Sean, there's a team from Liverpool coming over to play Skellig Rangers in the All-Ireland Junior Football Final in Croke Park. Would this be the first time that a team from outside of Ireland has played in an All-Ireland Final in Croke Park? Roughly, no, I'm not pinning you down, right?
They wouldn't. There was Tyrconnell Gaels that were over there, another one, and Unreacht.
Did they play in the final?
They play, but not in a final. No,
this,
no.
This is, but, this is an All-Ireland final now?
No, there wouldn't be. It wouldn't be an All-Ireland final.
Yeah.
But like the London GAA team has won the All-Ireland Hurling B Championship. Right, yeah. But that's about the only one. But club-wise, no. But they did have some very good teams from London, club teams. Yes, yeah. But they never got in, as far as I know, until now, into an All-Ireland final.
Sean, turning staying with the Kerry Minutes, what do you think is the secret of Kerry? They have two teams in an All-Ireland final, now junior and intermediate. They're winning, they win minor, junior, under 21 and seniors on a regular basis. They produce some of the best footballers ever for a small county. It's remarkable, really. What is the secret of Kerry?
If I'd known that, I would make $1 million, I can tell you that. The secret of Kerry is that they always looked up to always the team to beat. Once you've got a name like that, you must surely be the team that people have to beat or teams have to beat. I think, you see, that Kerry didn't have the... For instance, Dublin, and we'll compare the two. Dublin are in a capital city. They're opposed by soccer, by rugby, by every other sport, and they're all pulling from the same pool, 17 and 18 years of age. In Kerry, it's pure football and hurling. They're the two main sports. and they can live with that, and they can produce all these great teams that over the years that everybody else has to beat. And long may it rest like that, because we need that in Gaelic football.
You've seen them all, Sean, from the time we'll be talking about your own playing career shortly, but you've seen them all, the great Kerry players down through the years. Who comes to mind? I know there's so many.
Well, there's a great friend of mine, and I hope he'll be listening to your programme, I'm sure he does, it's Mick O'Connor. And Mick was a great friend of mine, and I've done interviews with Mick. Now, not easy at time to get him, because I brought a crew down with me to do an interview with him. And when I went to the house, I saw the dog outside the house. And I knew he was there. Because once the dog was there, the dog everywhere went with Mick. And the mother came out and said, I said, I'm Sean Og. Oh, I know you. I can know. I hear you on the radio. And I said, is Mick around? No, he went off to Skellig's fishing. And he wouldn't be back down until late. And we had come all the way down from Dublin to do this interview. So not to be outdone, and I said, you can only respect the man's wishes. He was a very shy man. And he wasn't given to doing lengthy interviews with anybody, no matter who. And I was very lucky at the time that I did eventually get an interview with Mick, and everything went fine. But he was one of those fellas that was born down below in the island, in Valentia. And I went to the school teacher that taught him. And I went up and got the book that his name was in as a little boy in the school. I went to other people around that I was sent to that talked about him. And that was the way we did the programme. So I did a programme down in Valentia. And it was like Hamlet without the prince. And that was the way it was. But afterwards he told me that he had so many commitments that he had forgotten about that I was going down. But he made up for the day around. So I never said a word about him because he's a great friend. He was one of my idols as regards football. I looked on Mick as the personification of greatness because he had everything going for him. And it was one thing that all boys should look up to at the time. That's what they should look for and aim for, a man like Mick O'Connor.
Well said, Sean. Turning to your own career, you played hurling and football with Dublin and you refereed in All-Ireland final. First of all, bring us back where you were born and how many were in your family.
Well, my mother and father, first of all, when they were married, they lived in Dublin in Munster Street. It was a little two-bedroom house on the near Glasnevin, around that area. And then my father was working for C&C. It was a mineral water company. And eventually a job arose in Natchez and Limerick. So he applied for the job and got the job. So they took off and they went to Newcastle West. Now, my mother was born in Ratkeel, and she had three sisters, one in Ballyhale in Newcastle West, and the other one in, I forget what the other one was now at the moment, but there were four sisters anyway. And when the summer came along, they used to send myself and my two brothers down below to all my aunts. We all stayed with various aunts around Limerick. And I was born in Newcastle West, but at the age of three, my father got an offer of a good job back in Dublin. I had little memories of being there. And I wrote that in a book of mine, Sean Oger's own story, that I remembered men with faces and hats and various things. And they used to look in the window of our living room in the High Street in Limerick or in Newcastle West where we lived. And they turned out to be the Wren boys. And they used to fight in the life that I used to run in. Yeah. And it always reminded me of Sean O'Shea Conn, who sang the lovely song, The Boys of Barn and Slider. And that's how I always talked about him. And when I recalled that particular story with Sean, singing that ballad, The Boys of Barn and Slider. But anyway, 3 years of age, back again in Dublin. And that's when I started then, going to school, being taught. And then the usual thing, growing up and eventually playing hurling and football with
St. What was your club, Sean?
I started with St. Vincent's, a very well-known, strong club. And I played with them for about 2 or 3 years minor. And then they had no senior team. And my father said, look, we'll get you into Owen Roe, who was more or less a Dublin-oriented team like the Vincents. But the Vincents didn't have, we'll say, country players or players from other counties. Owen Roe's did. They had Kilkenny men and there were Waterford men, Cork men, who played as well. Maybe one or two from each county. And that strengthened the team. And I played with Owen Roe then until they played and then played in the All-Ireland Hurling Final of 1948.
Talk to us about that final, your memory, Sean, who you played.
Well, the gas part about it was Weeshie In 1938, Dublin beat Waterford in the All-Ireland final, and there was only one Dublin-born player on that team. The rest were from all the other hurling counties. And that lad, Jim Byrne, played with my club on row. And when I started senior, he was still playing. And in 1948 then, we had improved the ratio of Dublin-born players to six. So we had six Dublin-born players, and the rest then were drawn because they were from the Fogs Club and Young Ireland's Club, UCD. They supplied players to that team, but they were all from various counties. I'll always remember probably coming out under the Cusick stand and the cacophony of sound when you walked out on the field, and the roar of the crowds would make your hair stand on. A lot of players on that team were very nervous, but when they heard the row or the big roar of the crowd, and that's what you meet when players go out for
a wall
of
noise.
A wall of noise, and it seems to be hanging there in the air when you go out, and it would take you about 10 minutes to get into your game before you realise you're now in the big time and you have to put up with this.
What about the game itself?
The game itself was a great game, but unfortunately, from my viewpoint now, I, with my club, I played at centre field, and maybe I might go down and play at left half forward. But I was picked on the Dublin team, for that was at left half forward, and I met the captain of the team, Mick Hickey, who was one of the all-time greats of the 38 side. And they came out roaring to win the All-Ireland, which they hadn't won in 38. We were a little bit inexperienced of the big time. And I would put that down to the fact that we conceded something like 3 and 4 goals in the early stages of the match, and we were never got back again into the game, although I did get a goal, and that was one of the satisfactions I had of scoring a goal. We scored 4-6 and they scored 8-something.
Was it a cracker of a goal?
No, I must say it was a very innocuous, because I ran in behind the defence, the ball hopped, and I just tipped it into the net. So it wasn't one of these great ones that Christy Reid would score from 30 or 40 yards. It was just one of these opportunist scores that I ran behind the defence and tipped it into the net.
What about your football career then, Charles?
Yes. Well, football again was very good, because I was playing with St. Vincent's, first of all, and then after that I went to O'Toole's. I'd started with Clanagail when I came out of Cloisterwira, and they had a team, Clanmurra. But Clanagail, you see, unfortunately, when I joined them then, had one fault. They put in all the county players they could pick up around the country and played them for the championship. And when the championship was over then, they could declare then for their own counties, and they went back to their own counties. And if you're playing, as I was playing all along with them in league matches and tournaments and all, but when it came to the championship, you were dropped, and these star players from other counties.
A lot of great Kerry players played with Clanagail.
Oh, they did. Ned Kennelly was another great one. Played. He played with Dublin, Ned Kennelly. Coffey, do you remember him?
Kevin Coffey. I think Tom Long played with Clanagail.
And Tom Long played with, no, he played with Ayrton's Hope.
Ayrton's Hope, you're right, yeah.
He won his county final in 56 with a team Vincent's had dominated for 7 years, yeah, until Ayrton's Hope came along. And Tom Long was on that, and also Matty McDonough from Galway as well.
Yeah. So getting back to the football, who did you beat in the semi-final and the final?
In the All-Ireland. Now, I played in the valley period of Dublin football. Vincent's were the predominant team, and I played with Dublin teams, but we were getting nowhere. And even though we were only starting to put good, strong teams together, we won the county finals, but that's as far as we got. I played with Dublin already in leagues and things like that, but not in the championship. We were always beaten in the championship.
Now, you refereed in an All-Ireland final, Sean. How did your refereeing career begin, and how did you find it?
Funny enough, I was predominantly a hurler. My club sent my name into the Dublin County Board as a referee. I didn't know anything about it until I got a card out from the Dublin County Board to referee a football match. And from then onwards, I got no hurling match whatsoever. It was all football. So the first match I got was a match between two of the toughest teams in Dublin. One was St. Margaret's and the other was St. Mary's at Sagard. And the umpires I brought out to me, one fella said to me, "Chauncey, by the way, are you insured?" And I said, "What do you mean, am I insured?" Because I can tell you why. If we go to St. Mary's and they lose, you won't be coming off the field alive. So that was a great starter. And the match happily ended in a draw. So that progressed me on We had a match in Croke Park between two teams, Finian's and another team. And in the course, I sent three fellas off. I sent two fellas off because they started fighting. And a third then came along running in to help the fellow who was doing the fighting. So I put the three of them off. And that impressed Patrick O'Keefe. And whereas they did the Dublin matches all right, I didn't get onto the inter-county panel. But Patrick O'Keefe then started giving me major matches. And I did the first combined university versus the rest of Ireland match. The first one that was played, I did that, which was an exhibition of football. It was marvellous. Martin O'Neill then gave me the Leinster matches. And the joke is about that, Rishi. I had to referee the minor match first and then do the senior match. And that was the position with Martin O'Neill. He wouldn't apply two referees. He made the fellow who was doing the senior match to referee the minor match as well. And I did that during my career doing the matches in Leinster. I'd won experience down in Longford. When I got down the field and waiting for the players to come out, this man came over to be an umpire. And he said to me, "Sean," says he, "did you see the crossbar on the post down below there?" I said, "What's wrong with the crossbar? Isn't it supposed to be a crossbar?" "Ah, yes," says he. "But that crossbar goes 3 or 4 feet out from the pole." So I went out, and sure enough, the crossbar had gone about 2 feet past the pole, but it should have stopped at the pole. And he says, "Well, the one down hits it and goes into the goal or goes out again, what do you do?" So I ordered the county secretary to get someone with a saw, and I got him to saw off the little bit of a 2 foot crossbar that was sticking out at one end, and I went down and did the same on the other end before I'd start the match. So then the Ulster Council rang me, and there were appointed referees for the Ulster Championship final between Cavan and Monaghan. And they asked me, would I be interested in doing the match? And I said, yes. "Well, the reason that your name was put down, we asked fellas to send the names of what referee did you want. And they all, because of my experiences with Leinster, they all put down Sean O'Callaghan as the referee." And that's what I duly did. So I did the Ulster's final in 1952 between Cavan and Monaghan. Now, when I came along now to the All-Irelands, I was given the All-Ireland semi-final between Roscommon and Meath. And I did that match. And I had a very experience in that match. A ball was kicked in from the sideline towards the Meath goal. And Brendan Lynch, he was playing full forward, and Big Paddy O'Brien, one of the greatest fullbacks I've ever seen. And I always hold him in my highest esteem as a player who played football. No matter who played on him, no matter who tried to interfere with him, he'd never bother hitting them back and never raised a fist or anything. But he happened to push Brendan Lynch as the ball was coming in. And immediately I blew a whistle for a free, to give the free to the Roscommon people. As the ball was coming in, the goalkeeper at the time didn't make any attempt to save it because he knew I was calling for the ball to be put in the spot. And the ball went into the net. So that started a great argument then, because I gave a free then to Roscommon instead of giving the goal, because at that time the advantage rule was only a figment of somebody's imagination. It wasn't a rule. And I didn't give the goal because the goalie knew he could have stopped it, for that matter. So weeks afterwards, I met a Christian brother from St. Vincent's in Sutton, where my son went to school. And we argued. He says, "Why," he says, "didn't you apply the advantage rule?" And I said, "There's no advantage, because," I said, "the goalkeeper could have stopped the ball, and I gave the free instead. Other people might have let the push go, and that would be the end of it." And I said, "What happened if the ball had gone wide going in?" "Oh, you had to give the free." So I said, "Well, you had two bites of the cherry then." So I took the one, the right one, and I said, and I gave the free. Now, then it came along to the All-Ireland finals. Now, having refereed the semi-final, I thought maybe I might get the senior final as well. So what happened is, Paddy O'Keefe then sent out a letter to the two minors. It was Cavan and Galway. Who do they want as their referee? And the first thing they put out was Sean O'Callaghan. So then I didn't get the senior final. I was very worried about that. But I didn't get the senior final, but I refereed the minor final.
Did you enjoy your time at refereeing, Sean? Did you ever feel threatened?
I did indeed, because I tell you why. You might remember, and I'm sure you do, Rishi, a great Tyrone footballer, Iggy Jones,
a wonderful player.
And I refereed a colleges match between Munster and Leinster. And he was playing with Ulster at the time. Ulster and Munster. And I remember well, he went on a solo run and he was being hit right, left and centre. But he was able to get away every time. He had a wonderful body swerve to get away from tackles that run around fellas. And I let him go all, instead of giving him a free from the first tackle, which he should have got, I let him go in. And he shot, went in, and about 40 yards out, he stuck the ball over the bar. And it was the longest run I've ever seen a fella with a solo run and scoring a point. And that gave me great satisfaction, because it wouldn't have happened had I given a free 20 or 30 yards before he got that far.
Lovely story.
Yeah.
Sean, we're here in Croke Park, and the G are celebrating 125 years since their foundation. What has that 125 years meant to you as an individual, your involvement, and what have been the great milestones that you have seen in the 125 years, looking backwards now? Anything at all that comes to your mind?
Well, now, the only thing I can say about the 125, I was brought up in a GAA house. My father, as you know, was very much involved. I was very much involved in hurling and football when I was growing up. And I said nothing else would have suited me better than, as I say, to stay as I was and not to change anything. And I didn't. And I think the GAA time was only coming into the picture as being a very, very strong organisation. But the one man who never got the credit for that was Pádraig O'Keefe. He was a visionary. He knew what he wanted for the GAA. He was a man that a lot of people were terrified of. Because when he went to Congress, it was Pádraig O'Keefe who did the job. And presidents at that time were only figureheads. Pádraig O'Keefe was the boss. There was a terrible lot of unrest all over the country in various provinces with the GAA over certain matches and certain decisions. Pádraig O'Keefe was the man who stood firm and settled them all. And he had great power. He used great power. But he kept the GAA where they were. They were the biggest organisation in the country.
In your estimation, so Sean, he was the major figure in the GAA in your lifetime.
He would have been until the time I had a few little runs in with him. Because the one I will tell you about, and I mentioned it at that lecture that we were at Wheeshie. When I took over, you see, there was an unwritten law that I didn't know about, that you weren't to announce the name of the player sent off in matches in Croke Park or anywhere else on radio. And when I took over the programme anyway, my father always said there was a man sent off, but never mentioned the man's name. Now, I looked at it and said, there were about 30 or 40,000 people there at the match, and they saw who was sent off, so what was the big deal about not mentioning it on radio? So when I took over the programme then, I mentioned a particular match where two players were sent off, and I named them. I said, one from that county, one for this county. And I said they were sent off. And on Monday morning, I got a ring from Sean O'Shiachán, who was assistant at the time to Pádraig O'Keefe. And Sean said to me, we were very annoyed, and Mr. O'Keefe was very annoyed about the fact you used the names of people who were sent off in the match in Croke Park yesterday, and there were 50,000 people there. I said, yes, I did. So there were 50,000 people at the match. Didn't they see the two people sent off? They knew where they were. So what was the big deal, Sean? I just mentioned that. But Sean, there was an edict given out that people doing radio shouldn't announce names of people sent off. It doesn't sound good to have men's names being mentioned as being sent. Say, what about the fathers and mothers of the players playing? And they're not at Croke Park. And they hear me saying that so-and-so and so-and-so were sent off. Wasn't that better than not saying it? And they're worrying, God, was it my son that has been sent up at that time? So it cut both ways. So anyway, he said, well, I'll tell you, Sean, that my instructions are to tell you that if you don't change your attitude regards men sent off, that you can always be replaced in the programme. Oh, that was the sting in the tail. So I said nothing. I said, OK, Sean, I got your message. I went immediately to the head of Radio Sport. At the time was Philip Green, the soccer man.
How is Philip at the moment?
Not bad at all. I hope he's well as I saw him the last. He's in a wheelchair at the moment.
Yeah.
But a very nice man, and I must say, a great man to work with and for. So anyway, the whole point of the story was, I told Phil the story, and he was annoyed that they're interfering with the radio, none of their business. Brings me down to the director of Aborda Fernacon and said to me, tell Aborda Fernacon, Mr. Fernacon, what happened yesterday morning. I told him what happened, and Fernacon was livid. He says, who told you that? Well, they said I would be replaced. Replaced from whom? Who is doing the business? We are radio. I'm the director, and nobody will be replacing you, no matter what you do on that program. So he says, now, I want you to ring Mr. O'Keefe, tell him to write me a letter and put what he told you in a letter so I have it here officially. So I rang Sean O'Shea Khan, told him, I said, now, Sean, they're very annoyed here. I said, I had to explain to them. And I said, my livelihood was at stake, that I would be replaced if I didn't react as the other people do, not give the names of people sent up. Now, he wants Mr. O'Keefe to write to him and to say this in a letter. That was the last we heard of Paddy O'Keefe giving out, because the next week there was a fella, and I did the same thing again, because they said to me, as long as you're on this programme, you can do what you want and say what you want, nobody will change you. Yeah. And that was the end of the story. We never heard any more from Paddy O'Keefe, and I made very good friends with him afterwards, and it didn't make any difference. But that was the end of it then. And that whole change, everybody on radio used to give the result of the match or wherever it was, and they would say so-and-so was sent out.
Even today, Sean De Geer are inclined to be protecting themselves. They don't like anything, any little bit of adverse publicity at all. It rankles a small bit. No, you also had the doing away of the infamous Ben. You had the opening up of Croke Park to other foreign games, and there were many more decisions made. Were they two big decisions?
Well, I'll tell you that in a minute, but I wanted to remind you what will always stay in my mind. The Tultian Games in 1932. My father was in charge of the South African contingent that came over. But I will always remember the teams coming across Croke Park, and I was only a little kid, young kid at the time, and an Irish wolfhound. You know the huge big Irish wolfhounds, the big dogs.
Yeah.
And they were in front, a very well on the team, the South African, the London, the so-and-so, the American team. And I'll always, in my mind, I remember coming across the huge, big dogs. I had never seen bigger dogs than the Irish wolfhound dog. They were as big as donkeys, huge thing. But I'll always remember that. Now, the decision about two men, first of all, and a Kerry man, Tom Wolfe, great friend of mine. And I used to give him, when I was writing my column in the Evening Press, I used to give him a lot of space, because he was a genuine man, what he was doing. And he wanted the ban lifted on foreign games. And he carried on a campaign for years. And he was beaten at the county convention, or he was beaten at the GAA. But eventually, the day came when people were beginning to see reason, that this ban was way back and there was a reason for it, but there was no reason for it in the present day thing. And that he went to Congress and he won at Belfast, and Pat Fenning was very much against the ban. He was the president of the GAA at the time. And like the gentleman that he is, he just simply put it to the members, do you want this ban to go or do you want it to stay? And it was voted by a big majority to do away with the ban. The Ulster counties were the only ones that more or less voted against the ban.
So you had this Kerryman, Tom Wolfe, who was hale and hearty here,
yes,
in Dublin all the time.
Yes.
A remarkable man, a great Kerryman, Sean.
Yeah, and a very great Kerryman with the civil server, and was also one of the selectors on the Dublin 42 All-Ireland winning team, because he was a president and he was very much involved with the civil service football club.
Yeah.
Too different to the hurling now. But he was a marvellous man. He got that done. What has the difference now? You see what happened there in Dublin, the Rule 42, who was the man responsible? Was another Kerry man, Sean Kelly.
Right.
And this is, where would you come from, the most GAA orientated county in the bloody country?
Yes.
Is down below Kerry.
Yeah.
And they were the wisdom again of the Kerry men. They said the Cork men are Kerry men with brains, of course. Mm-hmm. Wishy.
Yeah.
But they are the one that Rule 42 came in, Rule 42 got rid of, and they opened up Croke Park. Now, the world can see what a small country like Ireland has. A stadium second to none in the world is the Croke Park at the moment. And they did the Special Olympics, you might remember, was there. 58 million people saw that all over the world in Croke Park, one of the biggest stadiums. And it was marvellous. And that focused very much attention on the GAA itself. And the GAA, I think, in their wisdom, did the right thing by doing away with 42 and allowing their sports to be in Croke Park.
Would you be a follower of other sports, Sean?
Well, I can tell you, I have to confess, I played cricket. and I played soccer during my time. And I remember one occasion on the an Iron Tennis Club where I played tennis, they also had a soccer team. And being a great lover of all sports, I joined the soccer team. And I went down on a coach down to Carlow to play an AUL match. And I told all the guys on the team to call me John, not to call me Sean, because they might know who I was. And I went down there, and John was called all over the field playing the match. And when we were leaving on our coach, the chairman of the Carlow Soccer Club came over to me, shook my hands and just said, "Sean, I hope you enjoy yourself today." And that was the end of that. Yeah. So I loved all sports.
You're a prolific writer. You have produced a lot of stuff. Talk to me about your work behind the scenes at home and your writings. And have you been involved in drama? And you've been involved in a lot of stuff, Sean.
But let me say this much, that when I took over the Sunday game, I'll give you the pattern of my day doing that. I would go off on a helicopter, maybe down to Thurles or over to Castleblaney or over to Galway, come back with the film with the camera, have to do the commentary maybe on the match, or even doing somebody else doing a commentary, go into Telefee Sheridan, and I'd start the programme then, rehearsing about 8 o'clock, and then at 10:30 then the program would start and finish at 10:30. I would walk out of the film studio over to the radio where a girl was waiting with all my results that she had collected, hand me all my results, and I'd go in at 11 o'clock and do my GEA results program. I would get into my car and drive over to the Irish Press. At that time, I was the GEA correspondent for the evening press, and I'd write up all the matches of the day until 4 o'clock in the morning. So from early 10 o'clock in the morning till 4 in the following morning, I was doing the one thing, doing GEA, and then I'd go home at 4 o'clock in the morning to bed and to start it again the following Sunday. So that was my day, which nobody else would have to do but myself. As it turned out, even those who came after Michael Lester, he just did his own programme. But I did the television programme, my radio programme, and then I wrote my stuff.
How long were you doing that schedule?
I was doing that for 2 years. I did it for 2 years, and Con Houlihan used to sit beside me, and he'd be asleep after coming in, having a few scoops. And then when I would be leaving, Con would be writing his stuff then for the evening press for the same day.
Remarkable Kerry men.
Another remarkable. So I'm just emphasising the remarkable Kerry men that are in this world.
Now, you're a prolific writer, as I say, of GA books.
Well,
and as a matter of fact, our listeners will be delighted to know you have another one coming out at the end of the year.
Yes, and we've just completed now the Lee McCarthy story, the story of the All-Ireland Cup, which is a Lee McCarthy Cup. And I discovered one thing, that everybody calls it McCarthy, M-C-C-I-R-T-H-Y, when the man's name was M-A-C-C-I-R-T-H-Y. So now I've rectified that little omission for historical references and habit correctness, as I called it. And I've given that book in now. It's 68 All-Ireland finals, starting from 1921 when it was first presented. And then when I finished that, then I just handed that over to Gillian McMillan there a few weeks ago, and that'll be published at the end of the year. Two of the biggest sellers they've had was the Dubs, and the other book where it was The Giants of Gaelic Football. That was Mick O'Connell had him in, no doubt about Mick O being one of the giants of Gaelic football. But that was the way it was when I started this. I started the book and I got so much interest that I extended it all over the country. So then the 32 counties were mentioned in that book. And that gave a great lift to the sale of the book, which turned out to be two big sellers for Gillian McMillan.
And another wonderful read that I got great satisfaction of was a book you brought out called Tall Tales and Banters.
Yes. Well, that was Mick Wright, the great Offaly footballer. He had a publishing house at the time, Calma. And he asked me would I do that book. I said I would, of course. And it was suggested to me by a lad called Jimmy Gray's brother, Denny. He said, "God, Sean," he says, "you know a lot of people. Why don't you do a book about funny stories about the GEA?" And that's how that happened. Sat down and I did it. And I have 5 GEA presidents in it. And all the various players that had their experiences. Frankie Byrd, I remember, told a story about when they were training for the All-Ireland. A car came in to the training camp and two lads, and they gave them these pills, said that they're great energising pills. Turned them when they're out, they were for if you were suffering from constipation. So they discovered that this was the pills that were given by two cabin fellas who gave them these great stories.
It's a beautiful read, Sean. You mentioned Mick Wright there, the great athlete footballer. You probably don't know, Mick Wright was the first Gaelic footballer ever to get a yellow card in a match, because there was a trial game played in Killarney back in the early 80s and I was riffing it, and they brought in the yellow and red cards as a trial basis, and that was the first game, and they also brought in two solos and a hop, and Kerry played awfully. I was refereeing the game and I had no intention of putting off anybody, but at the end of the game, for the satisfaction of the crowd, the man I pulled for a foul was Mick Wright, and he got the biggest cheer of the day. So Mick Wright was the first man in Ireland to get a yellow card. Now, you were also mentioned another name, I'm bringing you back there, Martin O'Neill of Wexford, who was the Leinster, or was he the Wexford?
Provincial
second. Now, was he the man who refereed the 1947 legendary Polo Grounds?
Indeed.
Who disallowed the Kerry goals?
He did allow it, indeed. And then, you see, there was somebody else. The umpires were all well-known provincial secretaries and things like that for that particular man. Martin O'Neill did it. Now, that was one of his... they'll never forgive Martin for disallowing that particular...
Did he talk to you about it?
Yeah. Did I mention that in a book of mine? I mentioned about referees and people like that who did. But that at the time, Mick O'Hare made a big deal about that too on the radio, that the Kerry goal was disallowed. And it turned out, had it been otherwise, it would have been the opposite. Kerry would have won that All-Ireland.
Yeah.
So it shows you what one decision... Now, rightly or wrongly, now, not being there, you can't decide, or you heard it on radio, that if that was right, it was right. If it was wrong, it was wrong. So it's a case of making up your own mind at the time. But I'm glad to say, Richie, that you experienced the trials and tribulations of refereeing matches.
That's right.
And the names you were called as well, that you weren't supposed to be heard when you give a decision against certain teams, you know.
Yeah. Now, last night in Croke Park, which both of us attended, the names, outside of yourself, of course, the names of Micheál O'Hare and Micheál Mórthartaigh, who was present, were lauded, and rightly so. Two remarkable men. And, of course, yourself and Micheál Mórthartaigh got special presentations last night. Micheál O'Hare, I maintain that he had a huge bearing in the history of Kerry football through his broadcast. And then Micheál Mórthartaigh, another Kerry man. We keep cropping up, Sean.
Exactly. Well, now, let's say two of them. Let's say Micheál O'Hare was the voice of the GAA. Don't doubt about that. From the very minute, and as I mentioned in my little tribute to him, a young lad of 18 years of age going to school writes in to the director of Radio Éireann saying that he would like to do a commentary. And a few weeks later, the same man at 18 years of age does an All-Ireland football semi-final in Mullingar. And if the amazing thing about that, Jack... Joe Cahan always remembers that. He said it in an interview I did with Joe. He saw this young fellow at the sideline, and Joe used to was walking over the line at the time and saw the young lad with a little cap on him, and he doing an All-Ireland semi-final, which was remarkable. So he was the whole pivotal thing in doing GAA until Micheál then came along and took over. Two distinctive styles now, if you like. Micheál had a certain way of saying things, and he'd pick on little things in the field, a little dog running across, someone releases a hen and make a big deal about it. But that added to the atmosphere and the build-up to the matches. Micheál was just as good. He would pick on somebody in the crowd that people would know and mention that he was there as well. But that was all part and parcel of the game. Now, I was different because I did television matches. And my vision was just tell the picture as it's that people see it. A lot of them are doing radio commentaries at the moment on televised matches. And I said it's an insult to your intelligence if you're a man looking at that particular match. You can see what's happening. And you're talking about the fella putting the ball over the bar. You can see that. A lot of that should be cut out of commentaries on television.
Sean, what would your advice be to young people who might want to become radio GAA commentators on a match? What makes a good GAA radio commentator?
I didn't have in my time what Mick O'Hare didn't have, or Micheál Mórthartaigh, a little recorder. They now buy little recorders. And some of these lads, if they want to do it, all they have to do is to go to a local match and do a commentary on it. And they would know the players, send that little commentary into RTE. and asked them, would they listen to that, that you would like to be a commentator? And that's the simple philosophy.
What shouldn't you do when you're commentating in a match?
Nothing. I wouldn't tell anybody what they shouldn't do. If you're involved in doing a commentary in a match, that's the commentary you're going to do. And if you were that way inclined, some people overdo it a little bit, some of them underdo it. So it's hitting the happy medium. Michal does the happy medium because he has a lovely way of saying things. Michal was just straightforward. It was just, he wouldn't embellish anything at all. He would just do it as it happened. But the little bit of embellishing that Michal does makes it very much interesting and very, very, very entertaining as well.
Did anyone ever say to you, Sean, that the one thing that yourself and Michal Amarahartig and Michal O'Hare would have in common, the one thing, is three very distinctive voices? Has anyone ever discussed with you your voice?
Well, like everything else, no matter where I go, if I was in a shop or if I was anywhere else and I say something, oh, you're the radio man. That was like the day I went down to Mullingar and the fan belt went in my car and about 3 miles from Kinnegad. I was going to Tullamore. And here was I sitting with the steam coming out of the car and I didn't know what to do. What would you do on a Sunday? A lot of garages not open. And I went and saw a pump, a water pump in a field just beside the road. And I went in, there was a bucket on. I said, now if I put water into the radiator, it might help my story. So with that, the voice says, hello, can I help you? And I looked around, there was a caravan that I hadn't seen when I went into the pitch, into the little field. And this girl says, can I help you? I said, I have a problem. I said, my car, I said, the fan belt is gone. And I said, I'm trying to get into Tullamore, but I don't know what to do. You're the radio man, aren't you? And I said, yes. Oh, wait a minute. John, she called in to John, who happened to be the husband. And the husband came out and I said, told him my story. So see, you never said a good word about Westmead in your life on the radio. And I got a little foot, sir, but that was it. I said, oh, come on. I'm only kidding you, says he. He went down and he got 3 fan belts, brought them back and put them on my car. And he says, now, go off now wherever you're going. I said, I'm going to Tullamore. Off you go and I hope that gets you back safe as well. And that was the end of the story as far as he was concerned, all because they recognised my voice. Now, Paddy Flanagan, the secretary of the Westmeath County Board, couldn't understand it because I had said to the lad who'd gave me the fan belt, well, I said, the next time I'll say a good word about Westmead. So I met Paddy Flanagan. He says, listen, where were you going last Sunday talking about Westmead? That they were brilliant and they were this, that, and that. I thought they were bloody awful. Hello, Paddy. There was a little story behind that, says I. So I will tell you, I had to say a good word about Westmead.
Lovely story. Lovely story. Sean, your own family. Talk to me about your own family here in Dublin.
My brother Seamus played on the All-Ireland team with me, and he played with Owen Rowe as well, and played with O'Toole's as well as myself. My sister Maura had her own programme on radio, and that's when I went. When I started radio, I started on 2RN. When, as I said, 3 Kerry teachers had me, and the headmaster was from Carrigsevine, Murishoga Hahn, and he used to bring us into Radio Weird and 2RN and to do a choir or do little plays in Irish for the children's programmes at 5:30. And that was a secret all till I left Skullcullum Killa. I was well versed in the radio at the time, and I was only 12 and 13. And when I went in, I was 15 going into Colossus. My sister then, Maura, had her own programme on radio, and that was the children's half hour. And we used to do plays by Michal in Irish, by Michal MacLearmore, Shimshe Kushtina, like Around the Fire ballads. And we had a lad called Tomás Rosengrave, a lovely baritone, and Maura Froon, who was a contralto singer, and they would sing songs. And we had lovely programmes like that. And that lasted in the 30s into the 40s. And I had one particular miss. I worked in Portico Glasson in O'Connell Street. It was a draper shop and he sold Harry Gaelica a wine. And we had all the Gael goers coming in buying stuff there. And at the same time, my sister had the programme over in Radio Ireland at 5:30. Now, I stopped work at 5:30. So I had to run from the shop in O'Connell Street, only 50 yards and get in to Radio Ireland before the programme started. But unfortunately, I was delayed going up on the lift, and I get in and she had already started the programme, the little play we were doing. I was doing an old man in one and a little and a young man. She was doing the mother and a young little daughter in one of the plays, and she was trying to keep going until I arrived. And then when she saw me coming in, the relief that was on her, it was a half an hour play. And that was one of the little misses I had in my time on radio. But I got away with it. Nobody seemed to notice it at all.
How many family have yourself in, Sean?
I have Fineen O'Callaghan now is director of the news on television at the moment, Fineen O'Callaghan. And he went into the business with, forget his name now, who had a recording studio. He started there and eventually went into RTE, and he was well-versed and well-experienced in recording programmes. And Eamon Andrews, Andrews Studios, that's where he started. And then Andrews came in then, as you know, as chairman of the authority in radio when television started, you know. But I had two daughters, and there, Katrina and the other girl was Sinead, and Fineen was my son. So they're all Grail Glory names, and they all were very good
at it. And behind every great man, there's a greater person.
Isn't
that right?
Well, now you can say that.
There's a great woman behind every great
and
man.
And a great woman as well. Now, my wife was a beautiful singer and sang in the Theatre Royal and the Capitol. And eventually sang with Billy Dingle's Dance Orchestra as well. And that was her life when I met her.
Where was she from, Sean?
She was from Oxman Town Road, where Owen Rowe, my hurling team, where it came from originally. Yeah. And I met her at a dance, and that's how
what
I met her. She was named Anne McDonough. And she sang in the Royal and the Capitol then. Beautiful, beautiful singer, you know.
Where have your travels brought you?
All over the world. I went to every county in Ireland for radio and television. Every county. I did matches from them all. Yeah. Radio and television. And I went to New York, and I was also very fortunate that I was with the Cardinal Cushing Games.
Another man, John Kerry O'Donnell,
is another great Kerry man. And John Kerry was a great, because Tim O'Donnell was a great friend of mine, his brother, Tim.
Yeah.
And he had a bakery beside me, and I was very much involved with the O'Donnells and the family. And when I was there with John, then brought me over. And when I was over there for the Cardinal Cushing Games, leaving on a Thursday, when I got a ring from RTE to say you're to stay over and do the league final, that was on a Thursday, was on the following Sunday. And this was a great experience for me, because Micheál O'Hare got a heart attack coming over from the Derby, so he couldn't do the match, so I was over there. So they told me to do the league final. Now, the sequence of that was, on that Sunday, all the crew was there. I had a television unit with me, so we were filming and we were doing the radio as well. And when we went to Gaelic Park, it had rained mercilessly on the Saturday. Gaelic Park, New York, was a flood. There wasn't a part of it that wasn't covered with water. Game called off. Fixed for the following Sunday. Now, I'd been 3 weeks out with the Cardinal Cushing team, so this was called off for a week. So the next Sunday we arrived up to Gaelic Park to do the match, and the teams were all there, including Tipperary and all that sort of thing. Match postponed because Bobby Kennedy was assassinated. So the game was called off. So it went to the 6th week before I got time to include my commentary on the television and on the radio. And that was the way it is. 6 week in New York. I thought I'd never get out. So when I rang the wife to tell her all this, she says, look, the kids have forgotten about you anyway. You might as well stay there.
And were you in Australia?
No. I was never in Australia. Well, I had no purpose of going there, because in the Evening Press, when I was writing about these things, Mick Dunn was the man that went to Australia, and then they would use his report to the matches for the Evening Press. So I didn't have to go. I would have liked to have gone. That big man that played with Dublin, Jim Steins.
Yeah.
You see, he was very much involved in the father with the civil service club, and I know Jim very well, and the lad that came after him, the brother that played with Dublin. But no, I didn't get to Australia.
Sean, fate, I say, is very important in your life. You go to Mass on a daily basis.
Well, I have the unique distinction of being 70 years being a pioneer, and they presented me with the gold fauna and the badge as well. So they featured me in the Pioneer magazine as well with my wife. And I was very pleased about that. But it was said to me, oddly enough, by a lot of people that the way that when I see me with my pin, that they think it's great that I have an object to show that at least I wasn't a drinker. But I have ever since then, I have never missed Mass on the mornings. I go to Mass every morning, and I feel that it's part of my duty to go to Mass every morning, and I'm delighted to do it. And I meet a lot of people there as well. There are people who you'll meet every week at Mass or every day at Mass, and you form a friendship that way. And I said, without my religion, I said, I would be missing a lot.
Yeah. Any dear regrets, Sean?
No regrets. I live my life. I'm 85 and a half, as I said now. I'll be 86 now in May. And I have no regrets whatsoever. And the only thing I would have liked to have done was to have won an All-Ireland. I would have been set up for life.
And we'll finish up talking about one more famous Kerry man, Dr. Eamon O'Sullivan. You knew the man well. He trained 8 All-Ireland winning Kerry teams.
A gentleman, if ever there was a gentleman.
A huge man in the GAA.
Oh, and a big man in the GAA, especially in Kerry. And when I would go down, I'd ring him up and I'd say, Dr. Eamon, I'm going down with a camera crew. Would it be all right if we did an interview? Sean, you're welcome at any time. And I would sit down there with him in his lovely house and I would do interviews for television. And he was the man of the people. He had a great insight about football. His books, and I have his books, of how he trained teams and how he went about it. And the results were there, Weeshie. Look at the many All-Irelands he won under.
He won 8, lost 1 out of 9.
Lost 1 out of 9. Who had a record as good as that at the time?
He trained his first team in 24, Sean, and his last team in 64.
That would be quite right, because the television had started, as you know, in 61. And I had the privilege of going down, always doing interviews with him. And it was a pleasure to talk to him, because he treats you as an equal, because you played, you know, which made a big difference when he was playing. He'd say, in your time, Sean, it didn't happen. Yeah. It didn't. No, I said, in your time, it all happened. Yeah. And that was the difference. He was the man in Kerry at the time. And there was never rows in counties about this, that or other thing. He did his job and the results were there to prove it.
He certainly was, as the book says, a man before his time.
He was a man before his time.
Sean Auglisten, mate, it was a great honour and a privilege to talk to you. Thank you for taking time out. You're an icon in the GAA. You have given your whole life, not alone to Dublin football, not alone to the GAA, but to Ireland in itself. And come here, it was on behalf of everybody in Kerry. I want to take this opportunity of thanking you for your great voice, for bringing all those results, and indeed your dad before you. It was a great honour to talk to you, Sean.
It's a great honour to talk to you, Weeshie, and as you know, when you asked me to go on Kerry Radio, it was a pleasure, as I told you, and I loved doing it because I was talking to a man who knows the game, who refereed as well as you're telling me now, and I'd say you would have been a bloody great referee one way or the other, but with a soft heart. And that's why I like doing this interview with you. It's only a pleasure, and I'll do it any time you ask me.